Welcome to episode 20 of How Did I Get Here? 20 episodes, man. This one was done a remote job with my field recorder. I went and met Taylor Muse from Quiet Company at a place that he wanted to meet because they have a good wing deal today for lunch. And so we went and met at this place called Weirdos up in North Austin. Now, it's by the freeway, so it was kind of loud. And I use my field recorder, it's a loud... It's a different sounding podcast. It doesn't sound like this in the apartment. The nice microphones, the silence, everything. I don't regret it. I think there's going to be more like that. So I'm just saying, you, the listener, we've done a lot with our sound. We went out yesterday and did the Johnny V one, which came out today. Hopefully you guys like that one. And this one, I think you're really going to like. I first heard Quiet Company from Susanna Schauffele, or heard of Quiet Company from Susanna Schauffele. So I went looking for them and started listening to their music. They had a new album out. I bought it on iTunes. I was blown away. I started pestering Taylor to come on the show, and he came on the show today. So we went and met and had wings and ate. I don't have a lot to say. I do have a show on Sunday, October 30th, which is the night before Halloween. My band Liars and Saints will be playing at the Mohawk, and we'll be playing at like 10 p.m. So if you're in Austin, you want to come see Liars and Saints, come on out and see that. Other than that, I've got some Skyrocket shows. They're private. I know we're playing in Houston. I think it's the 4th, which is the Friday at Continental Club in Houston. Anyway, I'm going there this weekend to play a couple of private things. Maybe I'll do some hotel room stuff. Anyway... Episode 20 with my new friend, Taylor Muse, from Quiet Company. I hope you enjoy it. Here's my conversation with Taylor. Love, won't you stay with me? Till the moment comes for me. And burned down heaven and conquered hell. Oh, but you and I should live forever. 'Cause you and I know how to live. It's you and me. Our love is bigger than most everything. It's stretched out further. All right, Taylor Muse, the Quiet Company, or just Quiet Company.
Just Quiet Company.
There's no the.
No the.
Yeah. No. How are you?
I'm excellent.
Good.
How are you?
I'm doing very, very well.
Good deal.
I love your album.
Thank you very much.
I got it. I got two of your last album and your newest album. I heard about you actually doing this podcast from Susanna Schauffele the first time.
Oh, cool.
And then Dale Dudley told me about you guys.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah. So you guys just came back from CMJ?
Yes.
How was it?
It was awesome, man. It's our first time to do it. And we've been in New York a couple times.
Yeah.
But never for CMJ. And I've never really liked the city that much because I always seem to get stuck with the van and trailer. And it's just like... I don't believe in hell, but if there was a hell, I'm sure that would be a part of it in some way, is parking a band trailer in New York City.
Yeah.
At any given time.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so that always kind of dampened it for me.
Were you stuck with it this time?
No, this time we flew up, so, you know, we didn't really have the trailer, and we had a cargo van, which is much easier to park than the trailer.
Yeah.
And we didn't have to bother with it very much, so we just shoot around subways and walk in a lot and stuff, and
right.
much more fun.
So you played two shows?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah, we did the Steve Madden showcase at the Gibson Showroom. Which the Gibson showroom's always been real cool to us. When we got our gear stolen like a couple of years ago, like they lent us stuff to go on tour with and whatnot. So another one in Austin here. But
where'd your stuff get stolen from?
Our practice space here in town. We had just left our. We were stupid. We left the trailer like facing out, you know, instead right. of backed up against something.
Right.
So we were just kind of asking for it. And they jacked all our guitars and cymbals and. Like 3 days before we were supposed to go on tour. Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, super fun.
It was
right?
a lot of fun. But Gibson Showroom was among many of the people that like donated and let us borrow stuff. And so they called ahead for this tour and like let us borrow some stuff while we were up there as well. So
that's great.
Yeah, it was awesome.
As it's so expensive even to take guitars and stuff now.
Yeah.
Along with even your clothes.
Yeah.
Makes it difficult. I want to... Let's go back to the beginning. You're from East Texas, right?
Mm-hmm.
Were you born there?
Mm-hmm.
Where were you born?
Longview.
Longview, Texas. Mm-hmm. We're eating chips right now. We're having lunch at Weirdos in Austin. So Longview, Texas, that's near Nacogdoches, near Tyler.
Mm-hmm. About 30 minutes from Tyler.
What was it like growing up there? You come from a musical family?
Not really. My parents were, they weren't into music really at all. It wasn't until like I started kind of getting into it that I think my dad kind of realized. He was like, oh, I need to connect with my kids some way, you know? And so he started remembering that at one point he did like music a lot and started trying to get me into Neil Young and stuff like that. I was just really into Phil Collins at the time. And,
you know. What era of Phil Collins?
The Genesis, I Can't Dance album particularly.
Yeah. So how old were you then? Was it when it was out?
Yeah, it was right when it came out. Okay. You know, we saw it on... I remember we saw... Me and my brother were watching TV and some news show, and they talked about that record coming out and Criss Cross coming out.
Oh, yeah.
And so we got both of those records, you know? Like, my brother was more into the Criss Cross record, and I was more into the Genesis.
So was that the first music that spoke to you? Like... I've got to get this record. I've got to sit down and commune with this.
It wasn't the first record that I had, but I remember even when I was a kid, like too young to really even care about music at all, like whenever I'd hear a song on the radio, the ones that always stuck with me were always Phil Collins.
Right.
Like I never had the records, but there's something about his voice that was just so haunting to me, you know? Yeah. And I just, like, whenever I heard like something on the radio, I was like, I don't know who this is, but I love this guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was always the same voice. And then, you know, years later I realized, oh, it's Phil Collins and he's awesome. You know?
What a nice thing. You know, I know that he has a lot of personal problems with the fact that
he's had to retire.
Well, yeah, but also like a lot of issues with the fact that people like yourself or myself don't like him.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, he feels bad about that.
Why don't we not like him?
I don't know. A lot of people like discount him as like a schlock master.
You think so?
Yeah. Do you ever worry about that? Do you ever worry
that people see me that way?
Yeah.
Or that people see Phil Collins that way?
No. I don't know how much sleep you lose over Phil Collins.
No.
Not,
I guess,
I don't think you're a schlock master.
Sure,
I'm
just
saying, like I've just we're on the subject.
Would yeah. You, no. I've never had that concern. I guess, okay, but I've never seen Phil Collins that way either. I guess.
So. So you got this record by Genesis. I Can't Dance.
Mm-hmm.
And then, did you get an instrument
around
that
instrument.
Same time?
No, that was a few years later.
Yeah.
And I was really into drawing and stuff. And I'm a big comic book collector, or was until we started touring and I had to quit.
Why'd you have to quit?
No money.
Okay.
But since then I haven't really got back into it. But I wanted to be a cartoonist or a comic book illustrator of some sort, but then that wasn't really panning out, and So I needed something else to kind of get into, and I was really into like early 90s Christian hair metal, like Bride and Petra, White Cross.
Striper?
Yeah, all that stuff. And so...
So you raised... You were raised, obviously, Christian.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there's a lot of this theme throughout
all
of your music. So did you start picking up on that kind of thing? Was that what you were first kind of like playing?
Yeah. You mean like church stuff?
Christian metal.
Yeah. I mean, the church was like kind of like my first like source of music, you know, because you... Like the first show I ever played was for the church, you know,
right.
And the youth group and stuff like that. And played in the praise band.
What religion?
Southern Baptist.
Southern Baptist. Okay.
Yeah. And but yeah, I was really into that. And kind of youth group was like, when I started getting into youth group, there, you know, we a lot of bands that were like hip, like Christian bands, you know, to get into and stuff. And so started getting more into like, I guess more like relevant, like the music I should have been into.
Right.
It's like all my friends, you know, me and Tommy always talk about how he was listening to like Nirvana and stuff, and I'm listening to the Garmo and Key, you know,
yeah.
All these really obscure, like kind of cheesy CMJ bands, you know, CMJ, CCM bands.
Right.
So
contemporary Christian music bands.
Yeah.
CCM.
Uh huh.
So did you form a band in youth group with other like-minded fellows?
Yeah, I found two other guys that were like they were like the bad kids in youth group, you know, and my parents were really concerned about like hanging out with these guys, but like they were immensely talented guys. Like I still like think of them as like two of the best musicians like I ever played with. They just, you know, I only see one of them every once in a while now. I don't know where the other ones are. But I really learned a lot from playing with them. And they took guitar lessons at a different place that I took and, like, were way more advanced, you know. And they were in a lot cooler music than I was and that stuff. I remember Jacob was the guitarist. And I discovered Weezer's first record. And, like, that was one of... I think that was the first record I heard that I was, like... kind of made me realize like, oh, this is what I'm supposed to be into, like this is what I should be into now.
Right.
So I heard the Undone Sweater song on the radio, and I just remember thinking like, what is, like, I've got to get this.
Yeah.
Like, whatever this is, I've got to get this. And I did we had this youth retreat. It's like a weekend long thing called Disciple Now, and I ended up in Jacob's group, and it's kind of how I got to know him. And he was like, oh, well, I learned how to play that song out of one of those guitar magazines. And he showed it to me, and I could not play it for shit, man.
Right.
But I worked, like, that was the first song that made me, like, want to play guitar. Because I'd had a guitar for a little while, and I just hadn't been, like, it wasn't fun, you know?
Right.
But that was the first song where I was just, like, I was in there every day, like, practicing that song. And just, like, determined to be able to play that Weezer song, you know?
Right.
And so finally when it clicked, I think that was the moment that guitar just in general kind of clicked for me and started making a lot more sense and was a lot more fun to play.
Yeah. So did you start a band after that? You came home from your retreat?
Yeah, well, it was a couple years later, I guess. But me and Jacob reconnected in high school at a youth camp thing, and I think I'd become a better guitarist than he expected, and so we kind of reconnected and started this band, and he already picked out a name for it, which I've always hated, but it was 20 Watt Shed. I just think it's a terrible name.
Well, what was the significance?
There was none.
Oh, there was none?
Yeah, it was just, you know, kids that throw words together like Gavin Rossdale writes lyrics, you know?
Right.
You know, it's just a bunch of words that sound cool, you know?
Yeah.
But we were pretty terrible, but we thought we were alright.
What did you do? Did you play metal then?
Or, no, we were metal. We were
like
just
alternative.
Yeah, we were like several years too late to be grunge, but like that's what we were aiming for. You know?
Yeah.
And like he was obsessed with Nirvana, I was obsessed with Smashing Pumpkins, and so it was just kind of this like these two 15-year-old kids trying to write songs that sounded like those two things and not succeeding very well.
Right.
You know? Oh. Can we get another ranch, please?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. They usually give us...
We're having wings at Weirdos. Today's 50 Cent Wing Day. Yeah, 50 Cent Wing Day.
Yeah, I'm here every Wednesday.
You are, huh?
You want your celery?
Celery to start off with. So how long did you do these bands until you how were you in Isley?
There was a club they opened up. In East Texas, there's like very few places to actually play music. And especially if you're like Christian kids, you know, it's like,
right,
there aren't bars, and even if there are bars, like, you can't get into them, and you wouldn't play them anyway, right, because your parents won't let you.
Right.
Yeah. So, anytime there's like a Christian coffee shop or anything like that, it's like every band makes a beeline to like try to get in on this thing.
Right.
So they're opening one up in Tyler called Brewtones. And thank you very much.
You're welcome.
What? Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
What makes a Christian coffee shop Christian? Just an ownership the, just that and
they,
just kind of like
yeah, they the, bring in just Christian artists and
okay.
There's not beer there.
All right. Now, in your Southern Baptist, because I'm Catholic and drinking is a big part of everything we do.
Sure.
You're not allowed to drink?
No, it's pretty frowned upon.
Did at least you drink in, at all least in high in school? Did you break the rules?
No, I never drank in high school. I only had my first like drink of beer like a year ago.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So, go ahead. So there were Christian coffee shops who make a beeline to play them.
Yeah. So, there was one up called Brewtones in Tyler.
Mm-hmm.
And it was run by the Duprees who make up Isley.
Right. It's a family.
Yeah. And they had, at the time, those girls were in a band. Or they same band.
Mm-hmm.
But they were called the Toeheads. So they're all blonde.
Right.
And anyway, I saw Sherry there, the guitarist, and kind of fell for her, and we met and started dated for about 3.5 years, and just over the course of that, they kind of had a revolving door of bass players, and I was just kind of always around, and so had filled in for, and then eventually just kind of started being their main bass player for a little while. That was before anything cool happened to them, you know?
Right. And you gave them their name, because you are a Star Wars fan.
Yes, I gave them Mos Eisley.
Right.
And, which they insisted on misspelling, and said making it M-O-S-S Eisley, instead of M-O-S Eisley. Because they didn't want to get sued by George Lucas, but...
No one does.
Yeah. I don't think it was
except
gonna,
you, apparently.
Yeah, I don't think it was going to happen.
Well, they got into a position where they might have been.
Yeah, maybe so, I guess. But, I mean, they've been on StarWars.com. Like, so obviously... Yeah. So, I mean, I think, like... I don't think George Lucas, like, will sue you if it's, like, obviously, like, an homage, you know?
Right.
Which it was.
So, did they ever sue Nerf Herder?
No, I don't think so.
There you go.
Yeah, so... Man, I love Nerf Herder. I haven't heard about them in a while. Are they still together?
I don't think so. I just remember them sort of for that late 90s alternative pop explosion.
Yeah, they're great.
So you wrote with them?
Yeah.
Did you have songs on their
record? Very little.
Okay.
I wrote two parts of two different songs, and they were kind of stuck, like chord progressions.
Right.
No lyrics or anything. That one part for Telescope Eyes and another part for a song called Head Against the Sky, which I don't know if they've released or not.
Okay.
But yeah. I remain uncredited.
Oh well. So you left that band to go and pursue your own thing.
Yeah.
Where were you at the time? Were you living in Dallas?
I was living in Tyler.
Oh, you were?
Yeah, I moved over there after I graduated high school and I was going to college there, and kind of to be with them and stuff, and I just hadn't been I was in a band for a long time, and
what's that?
They put it in one thing.
Yeah
that's good. All right.
Yeah, it's fun.
It's like a date.
Hey, yeah. I hadn't been doing my own stuff for a while, and well, I'd been doing a band kind of as a joke called Neck Punch. We're like a real spazzy like hardcore band, and But I hadn't been doing anything serious, so I decided I wanted to do something serious again, and didn't have time to do it with all the stuff they had going on. And so I encouraged them to get Jonathan, who played on their first record.
Okay.
And they did, and I went off and did this band called The Connotations for a while. And we moved to Nashville after me and Sherry broke up, and went there for about a year. Everyone hated it, so we moved to Austin. And because I had never wanted to live here in high school.
Actively never wanted to live here?
Like, I actively never wanted to live here.
Like, I don't want to live there.
Right.
Thank you, man.
Thank you.
Just because, like, I had friends in high school that would always talk about, like, oh, yeah, we're going to move to Austin, and, you know, it's going to be so awesome. Like, it just felt real pretentious.
Yeah. I have a good friend. I lived in Houston. I moved here from there. A great friend. Same thing. He thinks it's just kind of like, it's cooler to live in Houston than live in Austin, because Austin's, okay, so go ahead.
Which I don't think Austin really actually is that way.
No,
now that
all.
I live here. It's great. I love living here now. But I had started kind of this relationship with a friend of mine named Leia, and then pretty much decided I was in love with her. So, I agreed to move here just because she was still in Tyler, and like, it just kind of got me closer to her.
Mm-hmm.
So I agreed to move with the band back to Austin, and you know, just mainly to be her. We played like 5 shows and broke up, and I started doing Quiet Company just to kind of, you know, keep rolling.
Yeah. So you started it, is it the same, you've changed some members since you started, mm-hmm. that what's going on now, so, I'm going to look at my notes. So you put out your first, release in 2006, was that an EP?
No, that was the first record, it's called Shine Honesty.
Right.
It's out of print right now.
How long after you put the band together did you put that out?
That was actually before,
You did that, right? That's the record
that one's,
you did
I did
on
by
your
myself,
own.
Yeah.
Okay.
I just kind of had these songs from the last band that I thought were too good to, like, fade into obscurity.
Right.
So I just wanted to record them. I had a friend of mine who had started doing recording and stuff, played for a band called New Frontiers, named Alex. So me and him holed up at his house for, like, 13 days or so, and just made this record with him playing drums and me playing most everything else. I had a few, like, friends come and play at different things, but...
Right.
And that record just got kind of randomly picked up by a label called Northern Records out in California. Uh-huh. It was like small little boutique, like kind of Christian label. And I was really juiced about it because it was a label was run by a bunch of people that were in bands that I always loved growing up, like Starflyer 59 and Lassie Foundation, Career Change, stuff like that. So I was just, you know, really excited, but then they didn't do anything, really.
Right.
Like, they made the record sound a little better, remixed it. But, like, past that, like, I don't know, like, anything that was accomplished by, like, signing that record deal.
Right.
But they were cool, at least, about letting us out, you know, right. When the time came.
And so by the time came to put it out, then you already had a band and stuff.
Well, they encouraged me, and they're like, you should get out and play shows.
Like that. We're both having this serious conversation and, like, covered
like licking
in sauce.
Wings. Yeah.
Licking our fingers. But go ahead.
It's very casual.
Sorry.
Yeah, so I put an ad on Craigslist and found Tommy and a couple other drummers that came in and out. And we didn't have a bass player for a long time. We played with Trax.
How was that?
It was okay. I think it was a lot cooler in my head than it was in practice.
Uh-huh.
Because I was trying to keep the numbers down at the time. Like, mm-hmm. I wanted the smallest band possible at the time. Like, that was cool to me. Like, now we're...
I like that you've changed that. Yeah.
Now we're the polar opposite of that. We're cramming 13 people on stage every once in a while, you know?
Really?
So, you know, I was wrong. It was a lot more fun this way. I think that I had, in my head...
I think, let me just ask you this. Do you think it's more fun that way? Because you got to go through it and let it build organically as opposed to coming out and trying to put together a 13-piece band. You know what I mean?
Yeah, probably so.
Probably gave you a chance to, like, grow into that sound.
Yeah.
As opposed to forcing that, like, coming out now and being like, oh, I want to do this thing where I have, you know.
Yeah, it was very much like, we started adding people when we realized we wanted to do more than we are currently capable of doing, you know. Right. So definitely. And I also think that in my head I was making the mistake of like thinking, oh, my bands didn't work out because there's too many people.
Right.
Like too many opinions. So the fewer opinions I have in the mix, the better this will be. As opposed to the truth, which I think is you just need the right people.
Right.
You know, and stop trying to force these relationships with friends, you know, and just... Because we like every band I'd been in before that hadn't worked out was friends trying to make a band versus instead of like having people that come together to make music and then become friends, mm-hmm. you know, which is how Quiet Company is and has been like the best experience for me musically.
It feels like that. So then you went and made your second record didn't come out until 2009.
Yeah.
Everyone You Love Will Be Happy Soon.
Yes. And that we were touring most of that time between and just trying to put a really big piece of chicken in my mouth right before I tried to answer that.
I'm glad we did this podcast like this. I think there should be a podcast where people are just eating the whole time.
Just smack sounds and swallows. I'm sorry, what was the question?
Question was, you go and make your second record. What was different this time?
Well, this time, we had full band.
Uh-huh.
Though we got back from tour in January, I think. Or, no, that makes sense. Whatever, we got back from tour and we were supposed to record like 2 weeks later.
Right.
But we just were not happy with the drummer we had at the time. So we fired him.
Okay.
After tour, and our bass player at the time was like, oh, I can play drums, which we'd never seen him do this before, you know? Oh, I'm sorry. I know. Like, we just kind of take his word for it, that he was like, yeah, I'm really good. I play like this guy. It'll be great, you know? So we just kind of trust that this guy was going to be able to play drums, and he was. He was really actually really good. And he played the drums on everything, but then he quit before that record even, like, came out. So it was just me and Tommy again, and put out another Craigslist ad.
You hold auditions?
Yeah.
Isn't that horrible?
It is. It's a pretty terrible experience.
Did you do it at your rehearsal place and stuff? Yeah,
at my house. We were practicing in my garage at the time.
How many guys did you have a day?
I think, well, for the drummer, it turns out, just as luck would have it, one of our favorite bands to play with.
Good. Thank you.
Was breaking up, called Ethan Durrell.
Okay.
And sucks to see them go because they were a great band.
Right. But
we snagged their drummer.
Right.
And Jeff has been with us ever since. But for a bass player, we put out another Craigslist ad, and we had two or three serious inquiries that we were considering, and Matt was one of them. And so I think it was just kind of a clear,
right?
You know.
Do you ever have anybody come in and just looking based on their gear, you don't want to play with them?
Yeah.
I had a guy like that, and I literally, like, was so fed up.
Yeah.
This is a long time ago at the Arc, and I was literally so fed up with my auditioning process that the dude brought his stuff in, set it down, and I was like, whoa, 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 before you go plugging this stuff in, would you be willing to change your whole setup, guitar, pedals, and amp? And the guy goes, no, that's my sound. And I was like, you know what? Let's not waste each other's time.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable.
Actually, Tommy, our guitarist,
right,
he came in. And his audition was just in my apartment. It was a really awkward experience. I'd never auditioned anyone before. And he came in, and I had had a little walk-in closet. I was sharing an apartment with another guy, and I just had my piano in there. Yeah. You know, so, like, me and him are in this, like, tiny walk-in closet, and he's playing piano for me, and it's real awkward. And he's playing guitar on my bed. We're sitting on my bed. It was just really weird. But, like, so I didn't see any of his gear.
Right.
But I'd kind of made up my mind, like, I don't want to hire someone that's like me, you know? I want to hire somebody that's different,
right,
you know?
Right, right,
that's not like all the people, like, so all my friends, we all like the same music, we all have the same kind of gear, like, so I wanted something different. And I knew that he had a Fender Twin Reverb amp, and I was like, okay, that's cool.
Right.
You know, pretty standard, you know, Fender Tweed amps are always great.
Right.
But what he didn't tell me is that he played a PRS through a pod.
Right, right.
Yeah, all this stuff. And it's like the things that I hate the most in music. So I had hired him already before I knew about what gear he actually played past. Yeah. I just thought, you know, oh, the amp is, you know, a sign that he has good taste, but it was not. You know?
Yeah.
So I had to tell him, like, nah, man, you're not going to play that stuff.
And he was cool with it.
Yeah, he's been...
That's good.
He's great, but, yeah, he still tells that story about how he brought me over to his house and was like, hey, man, I got these tones in this pod. I really want you to check it out and see if, like, any of these will work. And he went through one and the other. I was like, nope. Nope. I was going to say no to anything because I don't want that pod anywhere near me.
Yeah.
But.
So throughout this time, tell you your music, was it more faith based? Music, was it? Was it at the time, would you label it contemporary Christian music?
No. When I think of contemporary Christian, I think of, like, you know, what's actually on, like, the Christian radio stations here,
right,
like the Third Days and the Sandy Patties and all that
right,
stuff.
Right, yeah.
So I was definitely, like, you know, it was always, like, indie music. And I was always, whenever I'd write spiritual stuff, like...
But there are these kind of guys like Dave Bazan and stuff
totally.
That do this kind of music. And,
yeah.
You know.
And I always kind of viewed myself more like Dave Bazan. Like, uh-huh. That whenever I was writing about spirituality or whatever, I was kind of usually criticizing or being, like, blatantly honest with, like, how it was always falling short for me and disappointments and whatnot.
Right.
Because those are always the songs that connected with me. Like, Dave Bazan stuff especially.
Right, right.
Like, when he was, you know... Like, that Hard to Find Friend record,
uh-huh.
You know, talking about how there's that one line in there where he says, you know, if all that's left is duty, then I'm falling on my sword, you know?
Right, and, right.
Now some days I just don't love you at all, you know,
right.
Talking about God and stuff. And that was always just so powerful to me, because even
Why
the most...
Why is that? Did you question a lot?
I think I did, but I think that, at least on a subconscious level, like... But I think everyone does, you know?
Yeah.
I think there's... two kinds of Christians, people that doubt and liars, you know,
right.
And that's just, you know, those were just more human to me, you know,
yeah.
Then I was never really connected to the bands that were just like cheerleaders, you know,
right.
For the cause all the time.
Right.
There's just nothing.
It just doesn't
like,
seem real.
Right. Forced. And it's,
yeah.
It's very, it's whatever is accessible to a youth group in any given time.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. No, actually I'll just drink water from now on. Thank you.
Yeah, we're good.
Yeah.
Thank you. So yeah, I was never into. I mean, I had records from bands like that, you know, because everyone did, but.
But you didn't classify yourself as that kind of artist.
No.
Like
we
that.
Never. We certainly never set out to be a Christian band, at all. We just like because Tommy's always been an atheist, and so we played Cornerstone, and we were on Northern Records, and so those kind of things kind of I think like
right.
Made people assume. You know, okay. And I did have certain imagery and stuff, and I was talking about it because I was Christian. So I would, of course, mention it from time to time, but...
Right.
But I never thought that we were, like, you know, the Supertones or anything like that.
Right. And so then you did Songs for Staying In. It came out last year.
Mm-hmm.
And you did a lot of touring for it, and you did a lot of touring leading up to it.
No, we really
National
haven't been touring,
touring
a lot since... Since everyone came out.
Okay.
We about that time is when we kind of shifted our focus and just kind of, we were, you know, out touring, just kind of killing ourselves all the time and not making any money and not making any progress was the main thing.
Yeah.
Because we just weren't seeing it, like, pay off in any way, you
yeah.
know? Like, because we
yeah,
just
yeah.
play for bar flies that forget your name the next day, you know?
Sure.
It's like, it was all the self-booked touring and stuff like that. So we just kind of resigned to... Well, we had the epiphany that we're like, well, we're not drawing in Austin, where we're from.
Right.
Like, so if we're not able to draw in Austin, like, what business do we have being out trying to convince the rest of the world that we're worth their attention?
Right.
So about that time, we shifted our focus to kind of, like, just be focused regionally and locally and try to, like, kind of slowly branch out further and further,
right.
You know? And we were seeing, you know, bands like Toadies, like, pretty much just stay in Texas and do fine. Of course, obviously, we were not on the same level as them and
right.
didn't have any reason to be, but Bob Schneider and people like that, you know, just... Texas is a big place, and there's a lot of stuff lot of great markets, so within a drive.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it just made sense to us to kind of
focus
more on
that. And it's difficult now. I don't know how long you've been touring, but I mean, I've been touring since like, you know, the early 90s when gas prices were cheaper. It seems like
right.
there was less competition.
Yeah.
There weren't as many cable channels. There wasn't an internet. There wasn't, you know, 5 billion things that were, you know, mm-hmm. cheaper and easier, more feasible to do. So I get all that. And so you guys have kept it regional, and you've actually started picking up momentum then after you put out that record, didn't you?
Yeah, songs was kind of the thing that, well, songs is definitely, was the first like big step, I think, towards a larger audience.
Yeah.
Like everything you do, I'm sure you have seen this as well. Like you put your first record, and then you're able to convince a certain amount of people that it's worth listening to.
Yeah.
And they may tell some friends, and you'll play shows, and you're yeah. getting more and more friends and stuff, and it's expanding slowly. So that by the time you put out your next record, there's been enough word of mouth that about twice as many people buy your next record as bought your first one.
Right.
And then you keep playing, and you keep
right. yeah,
people keep telling you, and it's right. just like it doesn't only goes one way if you keep working, you
right.
know. Assuming you keep putting out a decent quality of product.
Right.
So you know, by the time that songs came out, like you know, we'd started to kind of draw in town and a few other places, and but the big thing was that like KUT has always been awesome. They've always played our stuff, but. KGSR, Andy Langard finally come out to a show, and he kind of got in our corner a little bit, and he got us on rotation there. KGSR and Trevin Smith over at 101X had picked us as a staff pick for songs, and so we got on rotation at 101X, and so we started getting actual radio play, like getting put in like decent to moderately.
And that turned your shows around
yeah.
a lot, didn't it?
And it just kind of increased our
visibility.
Yeah so we started getting, you know, more people that I guess were,
you didn't know,
taking us seriously.
Yeah.
You know, and
right.
like it, and just that exposure kind of opened up bigger opportunities and better opportunities, you know,
to open for bigger bands.
Right.
Rob Schneider
and the Toadies,
and
you know, Rooney and a few bands like that. So that made a big step. We're hoping this, now we got the new one out, and we're hoping that it
it's really unbelievable, this new record.
Thank you very much.
We Are All Where We Belong, and that's what it's called. We Are All
yep.
Where We Belong. And
yep.
you're coming to terms. I mean, I know that you've probably talked about this, and if it's old hat or if it's foreign to you.
No.
One of the things that I find interesting is I have a good friend in Houston named Jim Barkley. He's a you know, corporate attorney guy. And we went to a baseball game before a show I played. There was mm-hmm. an Astros game like a month and a half ago or something like that. And I told him, I guess that's when you and I first started talking uh-huh. or kind of got in touch. And I told him, yes, I'm gonna try and talk to Taylor for my podcast. And his eyes lit up. And he's very involved with his church.
Mm-hmm.
I know this because he hangs out with a lot of people from the church, and he goes. They do a lot of things with it. And he said, oh, he's... You're going to have an interesting conversation with him. He's had a point where he's questioned his faith. Maybe your new record had just come out.
Uh-huh.
And I guess he got it like first day on the internet. He's a huge music fan.
Oh, cool.
And a fan of yours as well. So anyway, so when he told me that, and I got back and I bought your record, because at that point I just kind of like... I've been suggested, oh, get this guy, you know, on your podcast. He's cool. And I was like, oh, Susanna talked about him and how great you guys were.
Yeah,
and
she was awesome, too.
I went and listened and I was totally blown away. And with the knowledge that my friend Jim gave me when I first started listening to your record, it opens up with this song called The Confessor, You Could Exist Without It. And all your songs have...
Parentheticals.
Parentheticals, yeah. So it opens up with the lyric, the river's wide, I could not swim across it. So I convinced myself I walked upon the waves.
Yeah.
So this just like, this record is loaded with challenge. Like once I heard that as the opening line and of the entire record, Then they're like almost these joyous. Well, there's it's almost like a there's a lot of songs that have like these outros that are big, and they're like like there's like a mantra almost. Sometimes it's just a melodic thing. Sometimes it's just one phrase repeated and stuff like that.
I'm glad you use that word, because that's the word I always use to describe it when I'm trying to feel better about my lack of writing lyrics.
Well, no. I mean, look.
But yeah, that's what they're intended to be.
You made a point, a lyrical point, more than almost anyone I know on this record, and just knowing that little bit about you, and then reading a little bit of press that you had had a child, and that you felt that you wanted to be honest with this child, and I came across the song "Set Your Monster Free." My New Year's resolution is to cope with my morality.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
I keep eating napkin.
That's what happened to you, isn't it?
Yeah.
You just couldn't stop eating napkin.
I just couldn't stop. Earlier when I told you about how, like, I'd grown in East Texas, but I moved to Nashville for about a year.
Yeah.
I think that's the first time just kind of removing myself from the place where, like, in East Texas, I'm not sure if you spent much time there or not, but, like, it's just like the rest of the Bible except for Austin, where it's, like, religion is just, like, poured into every facet of our culture.
Yeah, it's the cornerstone.
Especially there. I mean, and really, like, if you don't have a church to belong to, like, I don't know what you would do in East Texas, except maybe meth, which is apparently very popular. So, like, just, I think, kind of, like, getting out of that a little bit into a bigger city, in Nashville, which is also, as big cities go, is pretty conservative and very Christian. But, and all my friends there were Christians and great people and whatnot, and I don't, but I think just kind of removing myself from it kind of triggered something in me that, like, I was in a place where it's like, I'm free to create myself over as whatever I want myself to be. Like, I'm not hindered by my reputation or my past or anything like that. So this is a chance to, like, be the version of Taylor that I've always wanted to be.
The reinvention.
Yeah. And so, and I just remember one of the things that I wanted to do is I was like, I want to be a guy that reads a lot. Reads a lot of different kind of stuff. Like, I just want to be well-read.
Yeah.
I started reading all the time. And I remember I'd read a bunch of Chuck Palahniuk books.
Yeah.
And, like, I read, like, three in a row, and I started feeling like I was in this really dark place because of it, you know?
Yeah.
So I went to I was also trying to meet women, and so I was newly single, and I was up there, and I remember I went to a Barnes & Noble, and there was a girl that was working there, and I was, like, I asked her, you know, just trying to chat her up. I was like, hey, I just read these Chuck Palahniuk books. It's like a recommendation. She's like, oh, I don't know much about that. This guy over here can help you. And he knows all about it. And I was like, oh, I don't want to talk to that guy. But anyway, this guy was like, oh, you like Palahniuk? He's like, you should try Vonnegut.
Right.
He's a big influence on Palahniuk. So he took me over there and he showed me some Vonnegut books. And he, like, described the premises of several of them. And none of them sounded interesting, like, whatsoever. But I bought Slaughterhouse-Five just to kind of appease the guy.
Right.
And bought a couple other books and read the other ones first. And eventually got around. I was like, well, I got this Vonnegut, but I might as well try and read it. So I read it, and it just, like, just his voice, just the way he writes, what he wrote about, how he says things, like, just spoke to me in a way that, like, nothing has ever spoken to me before. And just, like, I finally knew what it was like to have a favorite author. And just the way, like, he would talk about humanism, and, like, he's always been very vocally about humanism, and to me, that was just kind of a buzzword for bad people, you know, a bad philosophy, because that's kind of the only context in which I'd heard about humanism was in church, and how, like, humanism and atheism and all that stuff was, like, the enemy of like, the religious thought.
Right.
And so I had kind of always viewed it as this bad thing, but the way he spoke about it, which seemed so beautiful and so, like, so reasonable, you know, and so I think that was the first, like, seed.
It also feels very honest.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's no, yeah, there's nothing being laid on you.
Right. It's not, you're not trying to sell you anything.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and so that was just kind of like this breath of fresh air, and I just remember just being really taken by the ideas, and I just started just devouring Vonnegut. And to this day, I'm just obsessed with the man.
Yeah.
And, just the things he says and the way he says them just mean more to me than anything that I've ever read in scripture. And, But that was the big first step, is I kind of started reading that. There's another Tom Robbins book.
Yeah. Which one did you read?
Skinny Legs and All, yeah. Which my brother-in-law had given me. And I tried to get into it and just wasn't into it. Eventually tried to read it again and got all the way through it. And I wasn't crazy about it, but there was a part in it that was really amazing to me, is one of the characters talks about how, you know, if the scriptures can be relied on, then the Jewish people perpetrated the first Holocaust in the book of Joshua,
right,
where they go in and decide that they're going to take the city of Jericho and Canaan, and these people have ostensibly done nothing to them, but, you know, God tells them to go in and murder everyone, and right, except for the prostitute that let the spies hang out, you know, and so they do, and it's just this terrible story, but I mean, they're the heroes, right? You know,
right.
And so that kind of triggered something in me that I like allowed myself to start like questioning, well, maybe this isn't such a good book, you know, maybe these stories aren't so good, maybe God's not the hero as much as he can be the villain, you know. And so I don't know, that started the process. So years and years of this and more reading and more conversations with people, and so by the time that we were, my wife and I, who is my friend Leah that I had mentioned earlier,
okay,
we got pregnant and gonna have this kid, and I just remember thinking, like, man, I haven't really believed this stuff in a long time now. Like, I just kind of come to terms with it on my own, but I hadn't spoken to anybody about it. Just kind of letting everyone assume what they wanted to assume, you know, that I was still the same guy.
Like, you didn't want to let your family down, or you didn't?
Yeah,
want to
I mean, I don't want to. I knew it was going to hurt my family.
Yeah,
like I knew my brother's a youth minister. Like, my right, parents are both very religious. Well, my mom is especially. But I knew that, like, it's going to raise questions. People are going to wonder why we don't take her to church, why we don't do these things, and why we don't like actively try to like get her to be one way or another. And I was like, well, I'm not going to lie to her.
Not indoctrinating her.
Right, exactly. So I just made my mind. I was like, well, I can't be dishonest with her. I've got to be honest with her.
Yeah,
so therefore, I've got to be honest with everyone else. And so that was kind of when I came out and started telling everyone. And then it became a big deal. And I started kind of obsessing about it. And all the songs I was writing started becoming about it. So I remember telling Leah, I was like, I think I'm just going to make a record. And it's going to be all about this.
Yeah.
And then I'll be done.
You don't have to explain yourself anymore.
Yeah.
So you go to lunch with your new friend Johnny.
Yeah.
Over wings, he makes you talk about it just one more
time. Yeah, that's the thing. It's like I kind of did it, and I was like, I enjoy talking about it.
Right, of course.
You know, but I just thought, I was like, I'm gonna do this, and then I'll feel relieved, I guess, a little bit. Like, the burden will be off.
Yeah.
Like, everyone will know where I stand.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so. Yeah, so the irony is that I did it so that I can be done talking about it, and now I talk about it all the time.
I'm sure, but the thing is that it's a fascinating part of the story
totally,
that a lot of people aren't honest about. I'm sure there's plenty of people out there that aren't saying what they really feel and are continuing just so that they don't fall out of good graces with certain people.
Right, and I think it's especially in America and especially here in the Bible Belt, it's just such a part of the culture. Like my father, I think, you know, feels like, and I don't want to out him at all, but like I feel like he, you know, just kind of, you know, he believes it, but I think he really believes it because, like, he's supposed to believe it.
Right.
You know, it's convenient for him to believe it, you know. There are benefits in him believing it.
Right.
You know. So I don't know. I mean,
is
I think
the,
that
is it the Amish that, like, they kind of give you a chance to go.
Yeah, Rumspringa.
What's it called?
Rumspringa. Yeah, that's where they can go out and
see what it's like.
Do whatever they want, and
right,
they have a certain amount of time, and they have to come back.
It seems to me a lot of times with the intense sort of Christian. Now, I'm Catholic, and that's Christian as well, but I'm Hispanic and Catholic, so it's like a completely different thing. People cry, and people are bleeding in all the pictures. It's very intense.
Right, yeah.
You pray for a job. You walk around with saints in your pocket.
Right,
it's very,
yeah.
You know, very iconic.
Very based
on, like, these huge, you know,
which there are, you know, facets of, like, you know, Orthodox Christianity that are very similar. They're all about the icons and the liturgies and
stuff.
Yeah,
liturgies.
But yeah, so I don't know, there's definitely parts of that and everything, you know.
Right, but there's a certain amount of. I mean, there's a lot of Christian bands that have had fallings out. Like, I'm thinking of I don't know if you ever heard of, do you know King's X?
Yeah.
They had a rough time because Doug came out of the closet.
Gay, yeah.
Yeah. And that's a cold... To me, all those things are very unchristian, those acts, to me.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, not at all saying anything with it, but to me, the act of your honesty and taking it seriously so that you can be honest with your daughter and raise an honest person, to me, is far more Christian than almost anything I've heard in a long time.
Yeah, there's a...
Or it says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, which is the same thing.
It's very humanistic.
It is very humanistic.
Like, going back to Vonnegut, like, Vonnegut has a quote where he's talking about how, like, you know, if it weren't for the Sermon on the Mount, I wouldn't even want to be human. I'd just as soon be a rattlesnake.
Right.
You know? And it's not that there's nothing good in the Bible. You know? It's not that, that Jesus isn't a great, you know, character or person or whatever.
It's kind of what certain people have chosen to do with that Bible afterwards.
Well, to me, the big thing is, like... Like I said, I'm a big comic book fan. I honestly feel that more of my morality is shaped from reading comic books than anything else. But I don't need to believe that Spider-Man is actually out in New York right now fighting crime.
Exactly.
To learn a lesson from that story.
Exactly.
So my whole deal with, like, Christianity is not that it's not useful. It's that it's not true.
Right.
You know? And I don't care how comforting it is, you know, or useful it is. You know, that doesn't make it any more true. Like, if the evidence isn't there to believe it's true, then I'm not going to believe it's true. Like, I'm not going to, you know, sit around and say, like, oh, there's nothing good that comes of it, because that's obviously not true. But...
Of course.
But if there's... But if we're talking about belief, then I can't make myself believe something that I just don't have a reason to believe.
Right.
You know? So... Maybe that's Calvinistic of me to believe that I couldn't, you know, believe if I wanted to.
Right.
You know, but I don't know.
Yeah, you know, it does serve a great purpose, and there's people that I have envied that comfort that they have. I have an aunt that has MS. She's had it for a long time, you know, about diagnosed for about 27 years now, and she still gets around on her own and stuff. She
that's
drives
good.
And stuff. But I think a lot of her, not just her outlook on life, but also her faith is something that's really helped her through it.
Yeah, totally. And my dad and parents are the same way. Like, they just, you know, my dad will always talk about how, like, you know, the comfort that it gives people. And it's not right for me to try to deny anyone that comfort. And
never, but then I don't think
but
that's
I'm
what
like,
you're
that's
trying
not
to
what
do.
I'm trying to do at all.
No. You just don't derive comfort from it, so you're not getting any...
But at the same time, like, I don't... It's like, you know, it'd be a callous, like, cynical person to sit here and, like, derive any joy from deriving that comfort from somebody.
Sure.
You know, which I don't think I am.
Right.
But at the same time, I don't feel like there's anything noble about embracing a lie because it gives us comfort, you know?
Right.
You know, I don't think there's anything brave about that.
Yeah.
Like, I want to give comfort to as many people as I can... You know, but I'd much rather give them comfort of the truth, you know, and whatever. But,
yeah, we're good. All right, do you need anything?
No, I'm good, thank you.
Well, thank you for opening up about that. So let's get back to the record. So did you make this record? You made it here in town?
Yeah, we recorded the same place that we recorded Songs for Staying In, which is right up the road at Matt's apartment. He built a big... isolation booth just right in the middle of his living room in his apartment, and so we rehearsed there, and until recently we got kicked out, but
that's awesome.
We recorded the last
two
things
that, there. That record in mm-hmm. that's amazing. What a gratifying thing to know that's you hear it on television, you know, music just done in Matt's apartment.
Yeah, just apartment. And he used to run a studio in Cincinnati, so he's no like slouch,
right.
But and he's got all the pro gear and stuff, but yeah, it was right there in an apartment.
There is a homespun vibe about it, like a record, we talked about Wings earlier, you ever listen to Ram?
No,
Paul
McCartney
record?
I haven't.
There's a very,
much into his solo stuff.
There's a real, made by people feeling to the album, to the music, to the recording, to the
execution. I've heard
that
about that record.
You know, it's very, and your record has that same sort of thing. It has, the songs are all, incredible songs. Mm-hmm. And just the fact that you really delved into yourself that much and you were so honest as an artist, so difficult, like, I don't know if you even recognize, if you're just like, that's how you express yourself so yeah. honestly. You might not notice how honest it actually is,
because yeah.
it feels more honest than a lot of things I hear all the time.
I think that's totally true. And I think that's true for a lot of people, but certainly me. Like, there've been times in life when, like, I'll be writing songs and like, I'll write a lyric and you kind of have that moment of like, well, shit, I didn't realize I felt that way.
Yeah.
You know, but then you realize, oh, I totally do.
Yeah.
You know, and like,
was there a lot of that on this record? Was there stuff that you sat back and you weren't like, whoa? Because yeah, there's a lot of like revelations. In
yeah,
there
was,
you know,
there was a couple moments where I would write a lyric and I just felt like, man, that's so,
it's too much.
It might be too much.
Yeah.
You know, but then we kind of had the decision that the same decision that we kind of made when we decided to make the record. It was because we had to sit down and we actually had a conversation, you know, with the band. Like, well, we can make another record and write more love songs and more stuff, and it'll be great.
You did that well too.
Yeah, we'll enjoy that.
I think they're honest as well.
Yeah, totally. But they're not controversial.
No.
so like, but we could do that. We could go in. We could write a little songs for. I could write songs for my wife. I could write songs for my kid. You know, and it'll be great. But we'll know. Like, we'll know
yeah.
that we made a conscious decision not yeah. to put out what we really yeah. wanted to put out.
Yeah.
Because we were scared of the reaction or whatever. So, like, it was that same kind of, like, thing throughout writing the lyrics. I'm like, well, I could change this, soften the blow, or I can put out real art.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm glad to say that we always chose to put out real art, honest art, at
Me
least.
Me too, yeah.
And, so I'm really proud of the record. I'm glad that it says everything it says, and
it must be also gratifying to get that sort of recognition when
yeah.
you thought maybe you'd be scaring some people off.
It's
to get
been,
such a warm reception.
It's been heartwarming.
And, yeah,
because we've had so many people come and say, like, "Man, just thank you for saying that."
Yeah,
like, I've never had a record say, you know,
yeah.
how I feel about this stuff before. And people are really,
what,
like,
an amazing connection.
It's amazing. And,
yeah.
you know, we've had people that connect to the music before, but never like this.
Yeah.
And it kind of sucks because we're not going to make this record again. So I wonder if, like, anything we do after this will connect in that way, and if I miss it, you know. But it's been really
well,
nice and gratifying.
You might not be going through such a struggle where you feel like the river's so wide you can't cross
yeah.
it. But, I mean, there'll be other things that
totally.
You'll be working through because you seem like a sensitive and perceptive person to me.
Oh, yeah.
It just sounded like a come on. But, you know. Yeah. You seem like a sensitive, perceptive
yeah.
person.
Let me show you
how
perceptive
I
am.
Watch me eat this chicken.
Yeah,
meat.
Watch this.
So, what's next? You did the CMJ.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a big show coming up this weekend?
Yeah, this
tomorrow?
Friday. Friday. We're doing
the backyard?
Yeah. It's actually moved from the backyard. It's at La Zona Rosa now.
Okay.
It's a wildfire relief.
Awesome.
No, for Bastrop and us and Bob Schneider and Nakia and Mother Falcon, the Rocket Boys. There's more.
I
can't remember.
How do you feel like you guys fit in this scene? Because to me, I think I've spent so many years kind of on... Mm-hmm. I guess just in my own thing. I don't try to be in any part of the scene.
Right.
I never really have.
Yeah.
But...
Yeah, we don't...
I've always kind of had an aversion to a scene because I feel like you're locking yourself in with stuff.
Yeah. I don't... Well, I mean, there's so many different...
It looks like you guys play with a lot of different kinds of
yeah.
people is what I'm trying to say. Like,
yeah,
you
totally.
Know, there's no, like...
And Austin's great for that,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, well, you seem to be an indie band, but without the chip on their shoulder that... say, oh, we're too indie to play with a guy like Bob Schneider or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
there's
sure.
a lot of that in town.
Yeah, probably so.
But you guys don't even, it's not even part
no.
of your... No,
we just want to get in front of people.
That's good.
You know, and... yeah, I don't know. There's so much different stuff here that it's difficult to, like, know if there really is a cohesive scene. I remember we did this show a while back, like years ago now. We were trying to win the spot on ACL. And we played a show with a band in town called Golden Bear. Huh? Remember them?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they were... I think they're still around, but they're not as active as they were. But, like, we got up and played, and they played, and they brought... We were just a three-piece then, but we still had the tracks and all the orchestration and stuff. And But they got up and they played, and they had like horns come on stage and, you know, violins and stuff. You know, I read a review after that show. They were great. And read this review afterwards, and the reviewer said, after seeing both of our bands, like, they started to think, well, maybe there is starting to be an Austin sound. And because it was real orchestral, like big arrangements and all that stuff. And I remember thinking, like, well, that'd be pretty cool. Like, yeah. Like if we got to be, like,
sure.
You know, kind of...
the definitive, the Austin sound of the time or whatever.
I mean, I definitely see, like, you know, I have a lot of amazing friends that are amazing songwriters. And I do kind of see, you know, we're pretty different. But, like, there are a lot of, like, we're all kind of prone to, like...
Right.
Throw another instrument in like why wouldn't we have a horn section?
Yeah.
You know, why wouldn't we bring strings? Why wouldn't we do this thing?
What brought that into your sound? Did it start happening like, you know, a trumpet guy and the guy's like, oh, I'll play on this song, or you started kind of adding shit on certain songs and you're like, fuck, this is amazing.
Yeah, kind of. When we did Songs for Staying In, we were doing a music video right before we started recording that for On Modern Men, which is a song on Everyone You Love. And there was just having to be this kid there, and as an extra, you know, he was just a fan of the band. And I started talking to him, this guy named Cody. And we started talking about, well, we're about to record this new thing. And I mentioned, I was like, yeah, we're just looking for some horn players to play on this couple songs. And his buddy's like, well, he plays trombone real well. And I was like, oh, really? Like, that's cool. Like, maybe you can come, like, play trombone on some stuff.
Yeah.
So... And they were like, yeah, he's actually, like, an amazing trombone player. Like, he's going to college for it. Like,
yeah.
He's got scholarships and all this kind of stuff. So, we had the show kind of, it was our first headlining show at the Parish. And so we wanted to do something special. So we, like, decided, like, oh, let's get a ton of extra musicians. Let's get string players. Let's not use tracks at all. Let's use, like, everything real. Like, so we got string players, and they're like, oh, why don't we get that Cody guy to come play trombone, and we'll get in.
Yeah.
Surely he knows a trumpet player to come with. And
right.
So he came, and he did, and we got a couple guys, and we just loved it, you know, just loved having the horns on stage. Like, it just made all the difference in the world to me.
And, also, it looks like a party. I watched that ACL taping of you guys, and it's just such a fucking...
It's
like
fun,
a,
man.
Yeah. It's
awesome. A lot of fun. And Cody has just become this monster on stage.
Yeah.
You know? Like, just
so
going
still
back
playing
and,
with you guys.
Yeah, he's an official member now. Like,
wow.
He's on the new record. And, like, he's just, people just love watching him. Like, he's just crazy. He's just full of energy.
Yeah.
You know, and, like, we love having him around. And, but, yeah, he just became a fixture, you know. And,
yeah.
And then he was on Songs for Staying In, a couple songs, but listed as an auxiliary musician. But
right.
Now on this record, he's listed as a member. And, you know, so it's just...
So let me ask you, on your trip to New York, what did you do about the big band? You took everyone? Cody went.
But...
I'm worried about Cody now. I'm concerned now. Does he have his own website where I can follow him? Is he on Facebook?
He should, man.
Okay.
He should. Well, the official band is just... We're five piece now. It's me, Matt, Jeff, Tommy, and Cody. So... That's how we play most of our shows. But if we're in town, like, we'll get some background singers up there, you know. We had a cello player the other night,
right.
You know. So, we don't typically have that many, but whenever we can, we like to, you
right.
know.
Yeah.
So, it's just kind of whenever our friends are around.
And, I like that.
And stuff, so it becomes more of a collective or whatever. But,
yeah.
But, yeah, when we go on the road, it's just the five of us.
And so, like, as far as songwriting, you write the songs.
Mm-hmm.
You bring them in.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys kind of... hash them out, or do you have them pretty much arranged? Or
with this record, every record before, like, I'll make a demo. It's a pretty, like, fleshed out demo, like, where I'll play the drums and do all the stuff and kind of come in and say, okay, this is how I want it to go, and everyone learns their parts, and things change slightly as we play them together, but for the most part they're generally the same. With this record, we wanted to not do that at all. We wanted to, like, just play them live and for a long time before we
right.
sit down to record them, see how they
okay.
changed, you know. But we just ran out of time. We did maybe three or four songs that way. And those all, yeah, the arrangements are great. You know, we're really
yeah.
glad we did that. Wish we could have done it on all of them, but...
Right, it would have taken a year and a half.
Yeah, it would have taken forever. Yeah. And it's just because we've got too much other stuff going on. Most bands that just get to be bands, like, they can do that
right.
a little easier. a little easier. We don't have that luxury. So we ended up just shaping a lot of them in the studio. We didn't do demos or anything, but we just kind of all sat down and I'd like play a scratch track and then we just kind of form it around that.
Oh, cool. That's a beautiful and very inventive feel to it. Like, you know, people having a good time recording music.
Yeah, that's one of the benefits of having Matt, you know, yeah. be a member and have studios that right. we just take as long as we want.
Right. You can actually do that stuff.
A lot of experimentation, yeah. not running out of money, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was a lot of fun. And Matt got to spread his wings a little bit.
So this record just came out, like, just a matter
of October 4th.
2 weeks ago, mm-hmm. 3 weeks ago. What are you, you guys are just going to keep on playing shows?
We're going to get back to Florida for another festival next month.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
No, we just did another one in Florida a few weeks ago. And that was really awesome. I got to see a lot of bands that I really wanted to see.
What festival is it?
It's called De Luna Fest.
Uh-huh.
It was really awesome, like, New Pornographers were there. Uh-huh. I never got to see them. I was really excited about that. The Shins were there. The Stars were there. Cake was awesome. Weezer, but I didn't watch them because I've seen them enough times to ever need to see them again. Uh-huh. But it was really great. Then we're playing Florida again at a festival called Orlando Calling. And I'm really super pumped about that one because the Pixies are playing and I've never got to see the Pixies.
Oh, wow.
So,
that's amazing.
Yeah. So there's not as many bands there that I want to see, but the Pixies are there, and it's the fucking Pixies. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow, maybe you get to meet them, too. I hung out with Kim Deal for a while when she lived in Austin. Like,
she seems really nice.
Years ago. She's
like on that
very
Pixies
nice.
Documentary. That...
I haven't seen that. I want to see it. But yeah, she's an interesting... she was still drinking then, and she was with this guy. Do you ever know this guy, Andy Taub?
Uh-uh.
He owned a studio in Austin, moved up to New York called Brooklyn Bridge. They were kind of a crazy couple. They were drunk all the time, but it was pretty interesting to see her, be around her and her.
Is she not drinking now?
I don't think you could go on like she was at that time. Really, like she would have a black eye and shit. You just never know where it came from.
Oh man,
such an odd girl.
Yeah.
Anyway, so you guys are gonna do more shows. And you're not really sitting down and planning the next record just yet.
We are, actually.
You are. Where are you at with it? Are you writing? And...
Well, the next thing we're doing is an EP. I wanted to do an EP for my daughter, where it's just all, like, for about her. So, the songs are pretty much started. Like, the framework is laid, but it'll be a while before we actually get in and start.
Yeah.
Making them actually take form, but really excited about it. We want to do we want the packaging to be like one of those cardboard like kid books, you know? Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And like this, like a few pages.
Golden books.
Kind of like golden books. Probably more like the infant books, you know? Like that are
built
so that you can't destroy
there's like
them.
Four pages.
Yeah. So we want it to be like that with the CD in the back, you know?
How old is your daughter?
Two and a half.
When she becomes aware of all this stuff, I bet she's going to be really blown away. Because there aren't a lot of like artist type of dads that. I don't see a lot of narcissism at all. But like you're just like if I was a dad, I'd be a lot different.
Yeah,
I would be writing songs about what a pain in the ass this kid has turned my life into or something.
Yeah, I'll just make sure to tell her that to her face. But no, she. I hope that she is like appreciative and like enjoys it. You know?
I don't see how she couldn't be.
Well, I don't know. When you get teenagers, you're just an asshole.
Right.
I'm like, oh, it's so lame.
My dad made this EP. It's so embarrassing.
Yeah, exactly.
It talks about my poo.
And then there's a picture of it on the inside.
Well, that's amazing.
But that's what we're going to do after that. We've, for a long time, had the idea to do a musical. And
finally. Right. I've been waiting for this for a long time from somebody.
And I still am really like committed to doing it. Have you ever seen Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog?
No.
Okay, it was this, Joss Whedon did it with Nathan Fillion and Patrick Harris, Neil Patrick Harris.
Yeah.
It's amazing, you know, and it's like this, there's like three little, like 15-minute episodes, and it's this little musical thing, and it's hilarious, and the songs are really awesome, so when I saw that, I was like, I want to do something like that. So, without trying to rip them off completely.
Right.
But we do kind of want to do something like
little episodic. Do you have a subject?
Yeah, loosely.
I thought you were going to say Lucifer. I was going to be like, wow, all right, this guy's turning around.
Yeah, yeah, we're really going the other way. But so we wanted to get around to doing that. Like, we've got, you know, 6 or 8 songs for that kind of set aside. You know, we've had set aside for a couple years now.
And yeah.
So hopefully we'll just get around to actually doing it and getting the right people involved with it. Because we just want to, we don't want to star in it or anything. We just want to do the music and
like,
have actual actors and actual filmmakers
awesome.
Do it. So hopefully we'll get around to doing that. And at some point after that, or probably before that, we'll do another record. I don't know. But
well, what's your website?
QuietCompanyMusic.com.
QuietCompanyMusic.com. That's how you can find out where they're going to be and what they're doing and buy their records. And honestly, Taylor, man, I'm so glad that we were able to do this.
Me too, man.
I really, I'm so glad that I learned about your band and got your music and really listened to it.
Thank you so much, man. I really appreciate you having us on.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. This is Taylor Muse, Quiet Company.
Thank you very much.
Oh. All right, so that was episode 20. That was outside. Sorry for all the noise. But anyway, that was a great conversation with Taylor Muse. Hopefully you made it all the way through it, and you got to the end there. I really enjoyed meeting him and talking to him. I can't believe we're 20 episodes in. Wow, 20. That was it. Now we're going into the 20s. Next episode, author Bruce Mahart. Episode after that, singer-songwriter Kelly Willis. All right, man. Thanks for sticking around. Thank you so much for listening to my podcast. Thank you for downloading it. Tell your friends about it, and let's spread the word. If you have any feedback, please write me. We have a Facebook page, How Did I Get Here? Go on there, comment. Talk to us, send us pictures or stories if you have about bands or any of the people that we have on here. Thanks a lot. Here's some more Quiet Company.
Well, daughter, I once thought that I had angels in my room. They were sleeping on my fan while I was dreaming of you. And daughter, I once had such desire to believe that our lives had been planned out by an unseen deity. But you don't have to waste your time holding on to beautiful lies. Daughter, I once knew that everything that I believed, it was good and fair and true and consistent with my needs. But daughter, almost as often as I'm right. So daughter, just be strong enough to make up your own mind. 'Cause you don't have to waste your time holding on to beautiful lies. No, you don't have to waste your time.